going to get that bit done. Anyway, like over here in the UK, I think board games have become like so massive because of lockdown. And the whole week, we basically, my partner bought me this board game, which was for, it's called, this the Jaws board game, like Jaws the film. And it's got Act One and Act Two on it. So it's basically two games in one. And the whole weekend away became about this Jaws board game because we were stuck inside because it was raining so much. And I could confirm, if anyone wants a board game to play, the Jaws board game is brilliant. But what it is you basically like, you someone plays the shark, and then you have, you kind of need three other people to play the three different characters, and you team up against the shark. So if you're the shark, it gets really, really stressful because you've got three people teaming up against you, and you're just like sitting there going, shit, the whole time. And it's like proper tactical. So my whole weekend basically became about playing a Jaws board game and walking a very small and excitable dog called Doug. can't complain.
We don't know each other. We don't know each other that well, Chris, but I'd struggle to conceptualize you sitting down and playing hours of board games. You didn't strike me as that kind of fellow. So, it's interesting to see that you did it. Must be the Jaws. Must be the Jaws theme, huh?
Yeah, it's not. I mean, to be fair, it's not normally the thing I'd do. I would have quite liked to have gone out like and gone exploring or something. But to be honest, it was really nice just to have a weekend of doing nothing and relaxing. Because for me, it's like I'm going into a really hectic race schedule, basically starting on Sunday for probably about 3 months. So, which is why having you, Randall, is actually pretty perfectly timed, because you know a shit ton about the word recovery. which is something I am not great at, and I think about 90% of all people doing sports are terrible at.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because as you know, like, you know, being the founder of Premix and also a sports physio, and we've launched a recovery cream in recent weeks, I've been quite a number of live chats with athletes, and part of it's, you know, to talk about Premax and whatever, but part of it's also just to get an insight about what they do with recovery as well. And I have to say, like, I've been surprised at how unsophisticated some of the recovery practices are of some very, very high elite athletes.
Yeah.
And when you say, you know, tell us about you, I'm expecting a laundry list of, you know, 25 things that they do. And it's like, oh, I have a nice shower. Or I make sure I eat well, or something like that. I don't drink beer. It's like, yeah. Oh, my Lord. Like, you should read that. Because I, you know, being a physio, and I read all the science. I read all the research. And I think when you're in professional teams, that, you know, particularly like the footballs and that type of thing, they've got guys who literally their job is just recovery. So they're just told what to do and what to do it. But you find that particularly a lot of the endurance athletes is like, they're so cooked after spending, you know, 8 hours kind of just pedaling as fast as they can or running as far as they can. It's like, at the end of the day, I just need to make sure I get a good night's sleep and get up and do it again.
It is really true. Like, I mean, I would say I'm not the best at it, but I would say I'm better than a large proportion of my friends. And like, for me, how I do it is like, say I've got training session. The first thing I do when I get in is eat something. And that could be, it really, that comes down to like time of day. Like if it's like lunchtime, it's going to be a meal. If it's like middle of the day, it's going to be something protein related. And then I try, but I'm terrible for it. It's stretching. I think everyone's terrible for it. I just get bored, to be perfectly honest. And then I normally have a bath with like salts in it, because I just quite like a bath after like a long training session. There's no two ways about it. I just think it's quite nice. And I'm like, meh. I hear a lot of stuff about bath salts. I've got some, chuck them in, do the trick. And then fundamentally, like, I've always found recovery lotions and sleep are really, really useful at night. Obviously sleep at night, but I'm someone that's not a great sleeper. So for me, it's been about like dialing in a sleep routine. And that includes everything from removing these objects, mobile phones, as much as I can away from me, and like giving myself. So what I've done on my phone is I've got like something that locks everything out at like 9 o'clock, and it just stops me being able to do anything on it, which is great because it stops me sitting there like replying to messages, doing emails. Like when you work like freelance, you basically work 24 hours a day because you're always like, oh, I should sort this out. And so having that like lockdown feature on the phone is great because it stops me looking at it really. And I try and give myself like a period to wind down in and then get into bed. And then when I'm in bed, I've got like, I actually listen to like sounds, like soundscapes, because it helps me switch off. And my partner's the same. Like we both have found that if we don't have anything, we end up like thinking about work and stuff so much, but actually it's just like an ocean sound one on Amazon Alexa and it does the job. And then the other thing that I've found really, really useful, and it's not really, I don't think it's necessarily a recovery thing, but just a general like waking up in the morning, is I've got like a sad light.
A sad light? What's a sad light?
So it's you're really lucky where you are, because it's basically your winter is probably as good as a British summer, to be perfectly honest.
not quite. Depends where you are in Australia.
Yeah. But so in the winter here in the UK, obviously it's so dark, and a sad light is a light which is designed to like kind of copy the sun effectively. And it's a big round sphere, like round disc. You can change the brightness on it, and you have like a more white light for in the daytime and a more sort of orangey light for nighttime and in the evenings.
Yeah.
And I find that if I sit in front of that for like it's probably all in my head, to be honest with you, but it seems to work. If I sit in front of that for like 10 minutes, I instantly feel so much more awake, especially in the winter, because the winter is always a time where I'm like, oh, I'm so groggy, I can't be arsed. I want to just hibernate and sit. And that really helps me. But I mean, at the moment here in the UK, like we've just done the summer solstice. So like last night, I think the sun went down at nearly 10 o'clock and it was up at like 4 o'clock in the morning. And
yeah,
it probably even earlier and later than that. But that's kind of when I really noticed it starting to go down and rise. And yeah, I mean, recovery is just like, I think it's an accumulation of millions of little things that people just, you kind of let one thing slip and it has a detrimental effect on pretty much everything.
Yeah. And I think, you make a really good point about, I reckon that, you know, like when you think about all the things that an athlete can do, and athletes of all levels, by the way, it just doesn't have to be someone who's riding tour, what they do for recovery, and it can get really prescriptive. You know, you've got to eat this, you've got to drink that, you've got to do this stretching, you've got to get on the foam roller, you've got to do contrast bars, and then the following day you've got to rub in this lotion and get so many hours sleep. And it can almost be overwhelming. And if you don't do it, it's like, I'm not training well, and, you know, I'm a bad athlete, and you start feeling bad about yourself. And if you're not feeling good about yourself as an athlete, you usually don't perform well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it can be a big negative. So, and I know that there's a lot of sports science professionals at the moment, and I subscribe somewhat to this theory as well, is that sleep's paramount. Like, you just need a really good night's sleep, and sleep hygiene's really important as well. And those devices that you look at all day are addictive, and it's really hard to put them down at night, particularly when you're a bit tired and you just don't want to concentrate. So getting your sleep is really important. But I think you kind of touched on it before, and it's a really interesting concept about mentally winding down as well. Mm. And so much emphasis is on the physical. You know, your muscles have just got to be ready for the next day. You've got to get your sugars back in, et cetera, et cetera. But if you're mentally tired and you're just not in the zone, you know, for the next session, then that can, you know, influence your performance markedly as well. So there's people who just say for recovery, and they tell their athletes, go barefoot walking in the forest, you know, for half an hour.
Love that. Yeah,
just go and just chill. Just go and listen to the birds and sit down for a while and feel the grass underneath your feet. Take a bottle of water and don't take your phone, and just make sure you're back within, you know, 3/4 of an hour or something like that, so you're not doing too much. And, you know, from the people that I've spoken to have taken that kind of philosophy, it works, you know, because they just come back feeling refreshed, energized, mentally ready. And, you know, they go and get a great night's sleep. They've detoxed digitally. And it's a really interesting concept. So, you know, as much as, you know, like I've been banging on for weeks about, you know, our lotion and what it does. And yes, I'm obviously advocate for it, and I think it's important. But, you know, I think there's a lot of hysteria, and it's such a big topic in sport at the moment that I think the one thing I've learned after talking to a lot of athletes over the last few weeks is there's one rule you follow, is just do what works for you. And, you know, if just a good night's sleep and having a sad, a sad lamp works for you, then do that. Absolutely.
I was thinking, like, the sad lamp thing, it was one of those things that I thought, oh, maybe it's like a bit of marketing bullshit, to be perfectly honest. But then I sort of, like, I'm very open about the fact that I struggle with depression and and I go through bouts of when it's really bad and when it's not so bad. And it generally is worse in the winter. And I put a lot of that down to it just being darker and more, like, dull. But also, so I used to live in central London. I used to live in Shoreditch, so pretty damn central. And I moved out to the Peak District in March, end of March. And here in the winter, I mean, March, it was like, you know, it's still pretty horrific weather, but there's so much more light, like just so much more light outside. And my place where I now live has got like huge, like double height windows in it. So there's loads of light coming into the property. When my old place in London was a flat, it was a tiny flat. And admittedly, the light was pretty good in it, but it felt very small and like compressive as well. And just having the additional space has really helped with that side of it mentally as well. And, you know, recovery is as much as you said, it's a mental thing as much as it is a physical thing, because, you know, if you know that like tomorrow you've got to ride or run or swim, whatever it is for, I just think for myself, I've quite often got 4, 6, 8 hour training rides that I have to do. And if you don't, if your head's not in it, it's going to be like 6 or 8 hours on a bike. If your head's not in it, it's going to be shit. So you need to like mentally kind of like be in a good headspace to kind of deal with that. And like for me, it's been everything, anything and everything from, as I say, the sad light, sleep, making sure I'm eating well and trying to keep myself mentally on the right train of thought. It's always about knowing what the goal is, like why you're doing it. And if you don't know why you're doing it, then it's like, is it really worth it? And you sort of start second guessing yourself. And as I say, this period for me, basically from, this weekend coming until October, end of October, is just like 100-mile time trial, 24-hour time trial, 12-hour time trial, 10-day gravel race, 5-day gravel race, 10-day race across the Pyrenees, rest. That's basically it. and I've always found it's like there's always like a period like this in the year where it is just really hectic. And I've always found it's really good to have that little break just before, have a bit of reset, eat what you want, have a couple of drinks with your mates, just chill out. And then you're kind of like mentally psyched to go into it. And you're like, yeah, it's good. I know this is going to be the way it's going to be for the next few months. But last year when I did this ride, which was 107 miles every day during the Tour de France across the UK. And that was a thing I did for charity. And I have to say the warm-up cream, probably the best thing I packed. Full stop. And I shouted about it quite a lot because, first of all, the size of it was perfect for the amount of days I ran out on the last day, which was hilarious. It was like the last day riding back into London, and I was like, yep, that's it. That's it, empty. Perfect. Leave the packet in the place of staying. And
I heard that. Was it how long ago? Was it 21 days that you did? Is that right?
21 days, yeah. Yeah. And
yeah. Okay. So 21 applications, huh? In 100 grams. So yeah, perfect.
It's perfect on my, and I used it, the bit that it worked really well on was my back shoulders. Because obviously, like, you think you're riding 110 miles every day for that amount of days, you're going to get aches and stiffs. And it was all across my back and shoulders. And then just waking up my legs in the morning, to be honest with you, because they're just heavy and a bit shit. And there's something very satisfying about the last day, just going, that was the perfect size.
And just what was it that you liked about it? Was it the heat in it? Was it that just you felt like it invigorated like you're tired? Well, it wasn't just your legs, obviously, was it? Was your upper back and neck and whatever? Was there anything else kind of in that product that just helped?
The heat was the thing that I really liked. And I really liked the fact that I felt like it sort of kicked in, you know, a couple of like 5 minutes after application. And it was like, I'd put it on, had breakfast, and then it was like, oh, that's cool. I feel like I've had a nice meal, had a coffee. I'm kind of feeling like I'm feeling good now. I'm ready to get, like, I'd already be kitted up and everything, but I was like, that little warm-up thing was like, I don't know, it just felt like it quite literally warmed my muscles up in as cheesy a way as that sounds. But like, whenever I was waking up in the morning, I was just feeling very heavy-legged. And there's nothing really you can do about that when you think of the fatigue over that period of time. And just anything that gave a little bit of a help was kind of worth a million pounds to me. And it was, I think, the warm-up nature of it and the fact that it was like, especially on my back, it's like warm and tingly. And I was quite like, oh, it's quite nice while I'm having breakfast.
Well, we actually use a different ingredient that compared to a lot of other Imbro creams and heat creams that you'd get down at, you know, Boots or and because a lot of those will use what's called wintergreen, and then there's a chemical derivative called methyl salicylate. So it's all in the household kind of brands when you're thinking about heat. We've got the different raw ingredient in there, which is called hot flux. And hot flux is a very different kind of warming experience to what the methyl salicylate is. And it's interesting just hearing the way that you talked about it, because, you know, a lot of what the reason we put it in there is that it's a comfortable warmth. A lot of people have said that it's like sitting next to a warm fire or something like that. It lasts a little bit longer. And you know, it's a very different experience. And without being too brandy, like, I mean, I think that, you know, that's something that we try and do with all our products is to make them a different experience, to make them really super useful for people like you who are doing what you do, and to make sure it's like, yeah, that works for me. That actually helps me kind of get to the next day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a physio by trade, that's always what I've tried to do, is just make sure people stay out there doing what they want to do. And, you know, if the products are doing that now as well, it's a mission accomplished. So it's really cool to hear that, Chris.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely really helped me. And as something that a genuine, on the side note, as someone who, so I suffer very badly from tendonitis, and I have never, so the closest I've got to solving this, I suffer it in two places. One is in my knees, and I've spent a lot of time with a bike fitter, a really good friend of mine called Tim Allen, who I think we're kind of like 95% sort of come to a really good solution for that. And they're basically custom insoles with a metatarsal pad on them. And the metatarsal pad just pushes up the base of my foot, and it stops me like crunching my toes in, when that's the thing that causes the tendonitis to flare up. And we seem to have solved that one. The one that we can't figure out is my hands.
Right. So
it started getting really bad in my left hand. I got hit by a car, and from that point it's been noticeably bad. I found that the first thing that I've found that's kind of helped, the worst it ever got was basically my hand was kind of frozen like this.
Yeah.
That was from riding across Australia, and I couldn't stretch my hand at the end of
it. It's horrible down here. It's really dangerous.
It's flat and it's very windy, I will say. And so I started in Perth and basically went straight across to Nullarbor and across to Melbourne, effectively. There was a lot of sandstorms and a headwind the whole way. I did it with one of my mates. We did it in 20 days. But yeah, my tendonitis was really bad that day. And as I say, it's my two smallest fingers on my left hand were pretty much frozen like that. So trying to open like bags, like anything for food was hilarious. It's like, can't do it. But it's the thing I'm still struggling with. The only way I've managed to sort of solve it is very well padded gloves seem to help. And acupuncture has helped quite a lot.
In the hand? Actually in your hand or kind of up in your forearm?
Up in my forearm.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Well, I'm glad that's sorting itself out. Yeah, that's a contracture. So that's, you know, that muscle's kind of shortening in response to some irritation somewhere. So I'm not surprised that the acupuncture has been really helpful. So that sounds like you're on the right track there too.
Yeah, it's been that sort of, and like I made a very conscious thing with all of my bikes, and you know, I'm really lucky to get to work with Shimano, but one of the things that I have very consciously done is remove mechanical gearing and go to electronic gearing. And the reason was is because with mechanical gearing, when you're changing gear on the shifters, you're pushing in much more with, because it's just because of how the mechanical shifters work. Your hand, there's much more movement like this. If anyone that's listening to this, you can't see what I'm doing with my hand, but basically I'm sort of wiggling it around. Imagine someone that's changing gear on their bike with mechanical gear. So there's that hand movement, but with a DI2 electronic gearing, it's just a tiny tap. And that's, I did not think that was going to make a big difference, but on a, you know, multi-day challenge or event over, you know, what I say is anything that's a week or over, in fact, even 24-hour stuff, that tiny movement as opposed to the larger movement reduces so much of that strain. I think it's just going to be a case of how to manage it as best as possible. And that's kind of the only thing you can do sometimes. Like every person's so individual, and this just happens to be the individual thing that is my kind of Achilles heel, ironically.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing I'd suggest for you is that you actually, you know, on the bike, you actually, people don't think about arms, but your arms do take quite a lot of stress, you know, in vibration and whatever. And then when you start to kind of add in, you know, your gear change and doing what we call that supination movement of your wrist, like it does ask a lot of those muscles kind of down your forearm. Mm-hmm. And cyclists never think about actually doing any strengthening for your arms, but that might be something that you might want to think about doing as well, is just some little wrist curls to strengthen up those muscles. And you might find that the shock absorption through there is it helps and you don't get that contracture as much.
That's a really good chat, actually. It's been like little, that one of the things I've consciously done over the last, I guess, 6 months as well, is because after I got hit by this car, I was having a lot of issues with my back. I slipped a disc or two. I was told what happened, and I sort of went, okay, yeah, it hurts. Slipped some disc or discs, plural. And the physio who I was working with said, like, you really need to consciously like build the muscles up in your back again, just to be able to strengthen that. And so that was a very conscious thing during the first lockdown in the UK, which, you know, it's crazy to think it's over a year ago now, and kind of still is just working on core strength, building up the back muscles a bit more, building up the muscles in the torso just to be able to support, you know, that, and kind of understand that, you know, maybe it's been slightly compromised, but you can build around it and help make it stronger in the long run more than anything. And I've always had like back issues, and I think that comes from just working at a desk as a, you know, I used to work as an architect, and I sat at a desk for many, many hours every day, and doing that when, you know, no one's chair is ergonomically set up correctly for them. And it means that you end up slouching or, you know, sitting in a weird way. And I think that just didn't help. And I found like with the fit on the bike for me, because I've got an over flexible back, I've got long arms and long legs, my bikes always look really good. And everyone's like, oh, you know, maybe you're riding too long a stem or it's too low and all this sort of stuff. And I'm like, well, I've worked with a very good fitter and we've tried shorter stems, like higher front end, all this kind of stuff. And effectively it's more uncomfortable for me. And being slightly more rotated, slightly what looks more aggressive, instinctively is more comfortable because it takes away, it's not forcing my back into an awkward shape. It's keeping it flat and working with the fact that I've got the longer arms and longer legs. And it's that, I think, like when you talk about recovery as well, having a well-fitted bike is so important to that, because you're kind of removing as many like things that are going to cause issues. And you think of the main contact points on the bike is your handlebars, like we've already kind of discussed, your pedals and your saddle. So like, for me, it's all about like, you know, making sure the saddle works really well for you. And I've tried out too many saddles to name. I've kind of settled on one, which loads of people always ask. It's a Pro Stealth. They do two different widths, but I found it works because it's quite wide. Even the shallow one's quite wide, but it has a very good channel in the center of it. So you're effectively sitting on your sit bones. And I think these like pressure relief channels are really, actually, it's kind of become a thing in cycling saddles that probably wasn't like even 5 years ago, maybe. And just having those pressure relief channels really, really help. The other thing is, you know, I'm a firm believer that chamois cream is the godsend of the world, because just if you get a little bit of friction, it just reduces that. And what I mean is like, not necessarily for like, I don't tend to use it for short rides. It's for long rides. And what I mean by short rides, I'm like talking like an hour or so. It's like, I don't feel like I need it. And a lot of that is because the saddle works for me. But the things that are like, I guess like 4, 6, 12-hour, 24-hour, that kind of stuff, it is so important just to reduce that friction. And also I think just like hygiene-wise, especially for the longer stuff, it really, really helps. I use the Premax stuff for the National 24. I've used it for a recent challenge, which was basically cycling from the England's most western point to the most eastern point, which is 700 kilometers. And it's like, for me, it was like, okay, I'm like 20 hours into this, I'm gonna need to apply some more. And it's more than anything, it's probably a psychological thing. It's like, oh, you know, I'm reapplying, I'm kind of like stopping a bit of that friction and uncomfort just by reapplying. And it feels a lot better. And also I think in my head, it's like, it's a bit of a, like a mental refresh as well. It's like brushing your teeth. That's something else I always do for long stuff, is I just brush my teeth. Because I'm like, oh, I've got rid of that salt, that sugary taste of that film that goes over your teeth from eating crap. And instantly it's like, oh, I'm fresh again. And I found like all these little weird little hacks really, really help. And a lot of the like recovery products and, you know, as I say, chamois cream, quite literally, reapplying that kind of stuff for the long distance stuff, is that mental reset, and it allows you to go again and sort of go, I break things down into 4 hours, and it's like, I can go say 16 hours is done. And it's like, well, okay, reset. We can go again, brush the teeth, apply some more chamois cream, get some heat rub on the legs, carry on. It seems to work for me.
Well, it's routine. And I think the other thing that, you know, like it helps with you is like you say, it's a break. And I think that with what you do, that break can be refreshing. It's actually interesting because not that I do what you do, but years and years ago, I did a walk, and it's called an Oxfam walk here in Melbourne. It's 100 kilometres. And I remember I got about 12 hours into it, and I felt flat. I knew that I was drinking appropriately. I was fueling along the way. I'd trained that much before, but the group that we were walking with said, let's just stop. And we stopped for 20 minutes. I sat down, had some pizza. And when I started walking again, I was like fresh out of the wrapper. I just felt great. And the only thing I could put it down to is it's not like I ate an enormous amount of food or anything, but it was just like you said, it was a reset. And I think it's really important on a micro level. But, you know, we're talking about it before as well, about, you know, how you're going to come into a heavy training period. I think that it's really important that you kind of do it on a macro level as well, and make sure that, you know, if you're coming into a, not only just with cycling, by the way, this can just be with life.
Yeah.
And that, you know, you're coming into a stressful period as you're ready for it. The other thing also is just talking about the chamois cream. I think it's a really good topic because, you know, I one of the things I think is not everyone needs chamois cream, and there's a lot of people like you. If you're just going to ride for an hour, 90 minutes or something, you know, most people kind of get away with it, but it's and this is hard, you know, as physio as well, is that a lot of these things you're talking about, preventative measures, and people don't want to hear about preventative measures. They just want to hear about what's going to make me ride faster. And, but when you break your skin, where you sit on the bike, like it's bad news. Like that's the hard thing. And, you know, you talk to the Team GB, and like at the London Olympics, they reckon they lost 2 or 3 medals with the female athletes because of the saddle sores. They, you know, these guys, they were playing around with their pitch of their seat and, you know, position of their bike. They were using this chamois cream and they tried that chamois cream, and they just didn't get it right, and under their own admission. And they actually had this big, massive internal review about how they can decrease the chance of getting saddle sores again. And I suppose following on from, you know, what we're talking about a bit earlier is you've just got to do what works for you. And I know that guys who ride in the Pro Tour and haven't used chamois cream in the last 10 years. And I know other guys who, and women, I should say, who are in the Pro Tour and they use chamois cream every single day of their life. So, yeah, everyone's skin's different. Mm. Everyone, you know, needs different care and attention. And I think that, you know, like, again, without kind of being too pre-maxy about it, but, you know, that's when we put our chamois creams together, like we think about 3 components. The first is that as a lubricant, it's just got to work. It's just got to, you've got to be able to trust it for 4, 5, 6 hours in the saddle and know that it's not going to let you down. The second thing is that, you know, it's got to have antibacterial component as well. And there's a lot of brands that will put tea tree in, and tea tree is terrific, actually. It's the best natural antibacterial there is. But it doesn't cover every bug. Mm. And that's why we pick 2 or 3 essential oils that we put in there that essentially broaden the spectrum compared to what just the two will do. And then the third thing is we want to make it skin conditioning, because even if you do have chamois cream on, if you're going to be having a big, you know, 3 months, 2 months or whatever you're going to do at the moment as well, it's just that repetitive kind of stress that can kind of break down skin over a while. It may not just be that one session that you do or that one ride. It can be a cumulative kind of effect. So it's actually restoring condition and repair, you know, having things in there that actually try and help stimulate repair of your skin. So when you do kind of jump on the next day, you're feeling good as well. So a lot of people just say, you know, just put pseudo cream down there and it's just a lubricant. And it's like, no, it can be a little bit more sophisticated and nicer than that. So that's the way we think about it anyway, Chris.
The thing is as well, like, it's interesting you said about the recovery side of it, is like I especially after the big challenges and rides, I will just put chamois cream on anyway, like just walking around my flat or, well, house now, because, and I think it is because of kind of understanding there's a, you know, there's the antibacterial aspect of it. And in my mind, I've always just been like, okay, so there's an antibacterial aspect of it. And, you know, you think about it very logically. If you're riding, so the last challenge, the coast-to-coast one, which was 29 hours and 43 minutes of riding, pretty much nonstop. Like, if you think about that in a logical way, whatever you think about it, you're going to, just because of the repetitive position, sitting on a bike for that long, you're going to get a bit sore and uncomfortable. That's just the nature of it. No one's, you know, no one's a robot here. And so, I mean, the week afterwards, I was just like generally just applying it, because I was thinking, this is just going to help. It's just going to help long term with that recovery thing and feeling fresher as soon as possible. The ironic thing of that is that I finished that on the Sunday, and then I came back to mine. I think it was on I think I got back home on like Monday morning at some crazy time. We basically drove through the night to get home, and then had my first COVID vaccination on the Tuesday. Not the wisest decision in the world. Very wise in the sense of getting it done. I booked it basically to get it done as soon as I could. But in my haste of booking it, I did not put two and two together. My body was already very, very fatigued. I'm just shoving a load of a little naughty little bug into my system, which does generally take up your immune system a little bit lower than you'd probably like. And I was probably pretty much out of it, I think, for a good week and a half, just gone. I had my first dose and got home. I didn't even make it. My house is on three floors, and the top floor is the bedroom. I didn't even make it to the bedroom. I made it to the sofa and just passed out. And it was like that for a couple of days. And I don't know if I've been trying to, like, I've been seeing quite a lot of stuff about athletes and, you know, general people talking about how the vaccine has affected them. And it's fascinating how different the response is. And it's very individual. Like, some people are saying, like, oh, I didn't get any side effects, nothing at all. And then some people, like, 2 weeks, completely bedbound. Some people like me, I was kind of like probably in the middle, a good week of feeling pretty groggy and crap. But I've been like keeping an eye on my like heart, my resting heart rate and heart rate variability during it, just out of curiosity. And my like resting heart rate went up 10 beats. And that's extreme. That's pretty extreme. Yeah. But it shows how hard your body's working in those kind of situations. And you think that's maybe more the extreme side of it, having done, you know, this long distance ride and then having the vaccine. But I found that tracking relatively loosely things like resting heart rate and heart rate variability has helped me kind of get a good steer on when I'm fatigued, when I need to spend more time on that recovery, that rest, and sort of making sure I'm getting a solid night's sleep and I'm eating well, because it is noticeably higher. And then equally, when I'm probably running optimally, where it's at the general sort of level, which is pretty good, like my resting heart rate is generally 42, I think. It's pretty low.
It's low.
I did get it. It was down to 37 at one point, which is very low. I was getting like alerts on my phone saying it was too low. You get an alert, like an alert saying like your resting heart rate is dangerously low, and I was like, shit. It's probably sits at about 42 at the moment, which is pretty good. But I've had it during my like just after the vaccine. It was like 56, so it's pretty noticeable as an increase. And I find it fascinating how like that's something that people probably don't think about in their routine. Like, there's so many aspects to this, and we're kind of covering a bit of everything, to be honest with you. And what I'm trying to say is what I think is really important to remember is, you know, life stress does affect your recovery. And what I mean by life stress, I've just been talking about me when I had the vaccine, but job, if you've got kids, if you've got a partner, if you've got, I don't know what it is, like, and those kind of things, like just normal day-to-day things, they add to this stress. And I think a lot of people discount that quite often in recovery. Someone's like, oh, I'm gonna have a rest day today. And on their rest day, they go and walk for like 2 or 3 hours. Now, I don't class that as a rest day. That's a big walk, you know.
That's a big walk. Yeah.
That's like, you know, 20,000 steps. That's a big time out walking. So that's not really actually allowing your body to rest. Similarly, if you're, you know, the mental side of it, like work stress can greatly affect your recovery. Affects your sleep, all that kind of thing. And it's a case of, as we sort of mentioned earlier, talking about the mental side of it, like being on top of that to allow your body to recover is going to allow you to you need to also allow yourself to mentally recover. They're so, so intertwined. And I think that there's a couple of things that are my like pet things that I don't think people fully understand. One of them is body stress and recovery. And the other one is nutrition. And I won't go on to a rant about that, but basically people just don't eat enough when they're training. That's it. But the two things are so, so like intertwined as well. And what I mean on that is like, you get people who starve themselves on the bike and then they come home and binge eat. And I'm like, well, just eat on the bike when you're riding so that your training sessions are good and you're feeling full. And ultimately, if you start to feel hungry when you're training, you probably have, you haven't eaten enough. If you're feeling hungry, you want to get home feeling like you're not starving. You're like, you're good. And so many people come home, they open the fridge door up, I see like a massive bag of like, I don't know, I'm going Australian reference, Tim Tams, a massive bag of whatever it is, and open it up and just plow them down. And then you end up feeling shit about yourself because you've eaten crap. And it's like a vicious cycle. So there needs to be this like education about how intertwined all of it is, from, you know, using heat rubs, using chamois cream, using recovery lotions, making sure you're sleeping, making sure you're eating, and ultimately making sure your head's in a good mental space. And I don't know the solution to it, but I feel like education is a good start point on that, and being able to showcase that with people like yourself the best way.
I think there's a big part to play with what we call athlete maturity. And that is that as you perform in sport, and not only in sport, but in life, you understand what's just routine fatigue that's related to training or stress or life, or what's not right. And I'll give you an example. I've got a friend who I train with a little bit, because I do quite a bit of swimming, and he's an Ironman triathlete. And he just said, I felt just incredibly flat. And he did one half Ironman, must have been about 3 or 4 months ago. And he said, I just couldn't go around as fast as I normally can. I was 5% slower, and life's been busy. I've had work stress, and I don't feel like I kept on top of it. But the interesting thing was he told his coach, and his coach is really quite tuned in and has trained a lot of Ironman athletes. He said, no, it's not life, it's your iron. Your iron's depleted. And my friend kind of said, yeah, right, sure. I'll just to satisfy you, I'll go along to the doctor and I'll check it out. And his iron was down at a level that, you know, like was almost anemic. So I think that, you know, like it's a really important point that, you know, you can. I think it's a really important thing to consider is that, you know, when you know, and like you, once you've been doing your sport and activity for a long time, you can really know what's routine and normal. But yeah, when things are out of the blue and they're just not normal, I think that's the time to get and yourself with some good people and stuff, because, you know, and seeing stuff all the time. Yeah, I knew what I was doing, and then I came in and saw it, and oh, actually you're right, I have injured this, or I'm not right with that. So yeah, it's like taking, we always use the analogy of cars. It's like you need to get your car serviced, you need to get it tested. Most of the time you'll drive it and it'll be fine. The oil itself, but you know, it's get professional, and you know, especially with people that are training at the level like you do, kind of a systems check, and agrees and all change is not a bad thing from time to time.
Yeah, it's so important. It is so important. And, you know, iron is something I do supplement as well, especially because I have a vegetarian diet, and it's one of the things that can be quite tricky to get hold of if you don't eat red meat. There are obviously things that do have iron in, but eating a whole bag of spinach is not something that really appeals to me, for example. Broccoli is another great source of iron, but it's quite easy also just to have a tiny, tiny little tablet and just absorb that into, you know, just have it as a drink. But yeah, that's a good point with the iron. I hadn't I it's something that I say I supplement it, but I always forget that how important it is still. I think that many people, it is, as you say, it's the analogy of the car, and a similar analogy I always think about is like a fire, and you have a fire where say you're making a barbecue or whatever it is, you have to like nurture that fire, you have to provide it with fuel, you have to keep an eye on it, keep managing it, add more fuel to it. And I've always like thought of it about in that kind of context. And it's the same, as you say, the car's the same analogy. You've got to make sure you're getting the car serviced. It's 90% of the time it's going to be fine. Keep an eye on the oil, keep an eye on the tire pressure, everything like that. And watch out for those warning lights on the dashboard effectively. And it is, I think, the more education that is out there for these kind of things, the better, and we'll slowly get there. One thing I wanted to ask you, what are like the biggest mistakes you see from some of the athletes you work with?
I think the two biggest ones are rapid changes in training load. So the obvious example is that just people get really enthusiastic about kind of doing an event, or they start riding with a bunch, for instance, and they just go from let's say doing 30 miles a week to 150 miles a week in 2 months. And their bodies just aren't prepared for it. Because the thing is the your cardiovascular system will respond really fast, your muscular system will respond moderately fast, but the rest of your body takes ages. So when it comes to kind of stress through joints, through your tendons, that type of thing, like they take many weeks, if not months, to slowly remodel and get used to a new training load. And I think that, clearly, like everyone's heard it all the time, it's like, don't build up too much. But the really interesting thing that you notice when you work with a lot of athletes, and again, all levels, but you see this particularly in the elites, is that if you go the other way, you can have just as many problems. So if you are used to riding 150 miles a week and you've been doing that for, 9 months and you've been training flat out, sometimes when you take a break and just go cold turkey, and then you get people who come in and go, I've actually been resting and I feel so much worse for it. Like all these kind of gremlins are popping up. My back's sore, my Achilles is sore, my hips are sore. So normally what we suggest is that any changes in load just have to be like rolling hills, and not steep mountains. So I think that's kind of the first one. Then the second one is just also listening to your body. And we've already touched on that before about kind of, what feels normal and right and a training load compared to what's pathological. And it's a really hard thing to, because one of the questions I get asked quite often is, how do I distinguish between good pain and bad pain? Like sports is supposed to hurt, isn't it? Like, and I'm supposed to, if I'm going to be riding for 12 hours, for instance, or running across the Nullarbor Plain, like, these things are they're going to hurt no matter what, but how do I know if I'm doing damage? And it's not a simple answer, but, I think that understanding kind of what is a normal pain, something you actually experience reasonably frequently with training, is different to what I call a pathological pain, which is an injury starting to develop, which is something new from persistent, sharp, that kind of thing as well. So yeah, training loads and knowing good pain from bad pain, they're the two things that I reckon where most people come unstuck.
The pain, I'd agree with both of them, especially the pain one. And the pain one resonates with me because I get asked it a lot with the ultra distance stuff. It's like, how do you, sure, like pain management is 100% part of those kind of races. It just is. And it's about knowing what is good, as you say, what is good pain and what is bad pain. And what I mean by that is what's good pain that's not gonna, which is pain that is maybe, I don't know, 70% mental, 30% physical. And also then what is pain that could do long-term damage? Then that's very much about how managing the ultra distance races are. And if you think it's that point where you're starting to go into that reserve of stuff which is long-term damage, that's when you need to make a drastic change. And whether that drastic change is stopping whatever the challenge is, because long term you're doing something that's quite serious. You know, you need, there's, and the other thing is, like, when you're talking about athlete maturity, I know that me 5 years ago doing the ultra distance, maybe not even 5 years ago, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, in fact, doing the ultra distance challenges I do, I would push through those potentially long-term damage things to complete stuff, because it was like almost a pride thing that I had to finish them. In contrast, now it's very much like, nah, it's not worth it. Bigger picture, it's not worth it. Let's just stop, reset, have another go. And that's as I say, that's something that's taken a long time to kind of accept that and understand that. And it's a, that comes down to maturity of understanding the sport that you're doing. There's a reason why not many people do ultra distance races, because the, like, the level of potentials, things that can go wrong, is so high. Like, it's not just physical things that can go wrong. It's things with the bike that can go wrong. It's things with your kit that can go wrong. It's things that are completely out of your control from external factors like weather, road surfaces, conditions. I'm just thinking of things at the top of my head that have gone wrong. You know, other people around you. There's so many external factors that can affect that. And yes, there's like an element of going, you need to, there is an element of like, things do go wrong and you kind of have to work around those things. That's fine. But then also being able to go, this is drastically wrong and potentially dangerous. There's a very fine line. And I refer back to when I was in Morocco and did the Atlas Mountain race in 2019, which is a gravel race across Morocco, basically. And I crashed very spectacularly on some like sand surface. I managed to bend the rear triangle of the bike, so it's slightly wonky. It was probably about 3 or 4 months after when I got hit by a car on my back. So I was kind of like recovered, but still a little bit tender still. Was advised not to go and do a 700 kilometer gravel race by my physio. And I kind of said, well, everything's paid for a book now. And she was like, you're an idiot. I crashed pretty spectacularly, and bent the bike, really mucked up my back again, and ended up having to pull out of the race. The bike was knackered, I was knackered, and I know that me, maybe even a year earlier, would have been trying to figure out a way to continue. And basically I rode to the checkpoint, and I was like, I'm going to stop for a minute, have a little bit of a reset, have some food, genuinely have a think about it. Is there a solution to be able to continue? The solution would have been swapping out the rear wheel, because I cracked the rim as well. And I was like, okay, there's someone else who's pulled out the race here. Let's see if their rear wheel will go in the bike. Their rear wheel didn't go in the bike, which I didn't realize. And it was because the frame was bent when I tried to put it in. I was like, okay, I can't ride anymore. My back's buggered. I'm going to pull out and stop. And, you know, understanding what is pain that could potentially be damaging, pain that's sustainable and manageable, and being able to accept that maybe it's not right to continue because you could do something long-term is super important. So, so important. And I think that only comes from experience, fundamentally, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, one of the my favorite questions as a physio, when someone comes in to me with an injury and they've got a deadline, you know, for an event or a race or whatever it might be, is I'll look them in the eye and say, honestly, how much does it mean to you? What does doing that race really mean to you? Mm-hmm. And what's important? And also tell me also what's important in your life. Is it important that if you did that race and that was the last race and you won it and you're happy, that's great. But is it more so that you prefer, we're talking cycling, you know, to keep riding for the next 25 years, you know, pain free? And when you kind of frame it up that way, like, people sometimes get that perspective. And it's a unique, I suppose it's a different kind of question from a physio, because a lot of the time when people come in, it's just like, all right, I'm going to ask them what their goal is, and we've just got to get them ready for that goal no matter what. But I think you're right, you know, and that is that, like, how important is it to you? And how bad is this injury? Is it just a little bit of soreness, or could you really do some long-term damage by kind of pushing through? And you're right, like the, you guys who do the ultra endurance stuff, you really push your bodies to the limit, and you really can bring yourself unstuck at times. And yeah, I think you make a really good point, Chris. So, and you, it sounds like you made the perfect choice when you fell off your bike and bent the triangle as well, for sure.
Yeah, my partner was coming out to Morocco for a little holiday after the race, basically. And I texted her and I was like, yeah, I've just pulled out, I had a bit of an accident. And she was like, what's happened? And I didn't really fully tell her because I knew she'd worry. When she came out and I was like, I met her in Marrakesh, and I was like hobbling around covered in like scuffs and cuts and bruises. And she was like, I think you did the right decision. And I was like, yeah, I think I did as well. I think I did as well. Yeah, it was one of those things which is just like, bigger picture, if I had tried to carry on and push on, I probably wouldn't have been able to have done like the ride across Australia later, things like that, or the 107 TDF ride, the ride around the UK. Wouldn't have been able to do that because it's bigger picture. Like for me, the how I've always structured my goals is like doing the ultra distance races are kind of like, I do them, I don't necessarily enjoy them. I kind of do them as a box ticking for kind of credibility. I obviously enjoy seeing the countries and the new parts of the world, but it's kind of a box ticking thing, which kind of keeps certain audiences very happy to see that. For me, the challenges that are charity focused are the ones that always mean the most to me, and I probably push myself much harder for those than I would a race, because fundamentally, they're about raising money for worthy causes, whether that's men's mental health, men's physical health, women's aid, which is about supporting equal rights for women, or also the other charity I work with is a school for kids with cerebral palsy. And, if it's one of those causes that I'm doing something for, I'm going to push myself further because fundamentally, going back to the pain thing, when people see people suffering, they dig deeper in their pockets for charity. I found that out the hard way.
Yeah, and you've done it. I mean, you are inspirational in that way, that you do so much for charity. It's just a pleasure to watch you do it, and you do push yourself through a lot of pain for the right reasons as well. So it's
Yeah,
a
thank
really
you.
cool thing you do, Chris, man.
Thank you very much. It means a lot to know that people appreciate the bullshit. Something I'm really conscious that it must be really late where you are.
Oh, I'm happy to chat, but it's now 8 p.m. and but like that's cool.
Yeah, because I always forget about the time zone differences in Australia and the UK. It's quite extreme. It's quite extreme. And you guys are kind of going into your winter now. We're very much in our, I say in our summer. It's been raining loads, so summer we'll call it. Something that I, we kind of covered a bit about recovery, mistakes that you've seen. Something else that I, what are like the biggest tips that you would give to people for recovery? That must be such a hard question. I'm sorry, but also I'm
No,
not.
that's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we've touched on a few already. I mean, the evidence will say that the number one by a country mile is sleep. And, we've already, and again, we've already kind of covered this off. And it's not only about just saying, yeah, sleep's important, but how do you get a good sleep? How do you ensure it? And I think some of the stuff that you spoke about before, about kind of getting your device off, the other ones obviously is, reducing caffeine. The other, there's a really good school of thought about not eating about 2 or 3 hours before you go to sleep as well. Don't go to bed with a full stomach. Those will help ensure that you get really good sleep. Then everything else, I think that's the number one, and for everyone that's important, no matter who you are. And then everything else, I think, is an experiment, because as we said before, I think just whatever works, works. And if it's massage that really works for you, foam rolling, you know, contrast bars, icing, active recoveries. There's all sorts of things you can do. And I like for everyone, what I'd suggest they do is just don't take it as gospel, whatever Chris Hall says or the coach down the road says or whatever. It's like, this is the be all and end all. Like, I really think that it's a personal preference type thing, as long as you're getting enough sleep and you're getting enough nutrition kind of afterwards. Then I suppose, you know, thinking about, you know, pre-max, I mean, the thing that we found really interesting about recovery was that, you know, we're always talking about, you know, recovery of the muscles and recovery and replenishing energy stores and that type of thing. But, and we've already touched on this a little bit as well, Chris, but, you know, recovery of your skin is really important as well. Your skin gets dehydrated, it gets chafed, you get saddle sores. And even though you may not have gaping holes kind of in there, like you suggested earlier, like, you know, just being on the bike for a long time, day after day, can you can get some cumulative type of stress down there as well. So that's why we put this recovery cream together, is to essentially kind of help the skin bounce back after sport. So it's ready to kind of go the next day. And we put sour cherry in there as well. So the sour cherry is a fruit extract. That can help accelerate systematic recovery as well. So, in answer to your question, sleep and whatever else works.
It's very much about, isn't it, like trying different things and working out what's best for you. And as you sort of said, it could be anything from, you know, I don't know what an example would be, like eating a massive tub of yogurt. Fine, if it works for you, it works for you. I love yogurt, so it'd probably work for me, but, you know, whatever, you know, and as you say, it's not all, and there's so much research and information out there. So I guess my stance on it is very much is like, try everything and work out and then funnel it down to kind of go, this thing kind of seems to work for me, this thing kind of works for me. And eventually you're going to find your perfect solution, which is going to allow you to perform better day in, day out for whatever it is you want to do and what you're trying to achieve. And as we sort of mentioned very early on, it's not always about this. We're not just talking in the context of athletes. We're talking in the context of anyone out there, whether you're, you know, new to a sport, trying out a sport, don't even like sport, you know, whatever it is, recovery and sleep and allowing yourself to perform are so fundamental. And this, like, it's things like one of the things that I found really interesting about the whole topic of recovery is kind of, it feels like over the last, I don't know, year or two, it's become a bit more mainstream. Like, people are actually talking about it a bit more. We're seeing that from, you know, things like the Whoop bands and other such, you know, performance trackers, like with what Garmin are doing with their, I don't even know what it's called now, Garmin stuff, technology things, or I should know. I'm wearing a freaking Garmin watch, like I should have a bit of an idea. Don't really know. But, you know, you're seeing it from, you know, brands like Garmin, Whoop, Fitbit, Apple Watches, whatever it is, that the sleep thing and the recovery thing is starting to be talked about in a more mainstream sense. And I find it quite interesting, like with Whoop, for example, how their podcast, they don't just talk to athletes. They talk to businessmen and businesswomen and discuss like how day-to-day life stress affects them. One of the ones that always stands out to me that I thought was really interesting is this is early on, really early on into Whoop's existence, was I did a podcast with a pro skateboarder and also a WWE wrestler, which I was like, of course they're athletes, but you don't necessarily think about it in that sort of sense of the word. There's, you know, they're incredibly talented and skilled athletes. And it was very interesting to hear that, like, the wrestlers in particular, they weren't really talking about, when they were talking about recovery, they were talking about it in the sense that they travel so much. You know, wrestling, you're doing it, I mean, it's definitely much bigger in the US than, say, anywhere else in the world. But it's, you know, the traveling state to state where they're doing a performance for a night or two nights and then traveling again to another state. And they might be in a truck or on a plane, whatever it is, but they could be traveling for like 8-10 hours and then having to perform again the same night. And that's where, like, listening to their stance on recovery is really interesting. And Whoop, give it or leave it as a device. I have a bit of a love-hate relationship with it. I think it's very clever. I think it's very expensive. I am wearing one, but equally, as I say, I think it is clever and very expensive, and maybe prices a lot of people out of what they provide. But also, there are much varied and other cheaper options out there. As I said, things like you can look at things like the Apple Watch or Fitbit, et cetera, who make those different things like that. I did also see that there's a brand that's bought a ring out that basically does a very similar thing. I can't remember the name of it, but I thought that was quite interesting because it's quite subtle.
Yeah, no, I've heard of that as well. I can't think of the brand either, but and going back to your point about how recovery is not only just for athletes. I mean, I run a company. It's busy. It's growing. I've got long days. And as much as I, enjoy exercising, I'm also thinking about recovery in context of making sure I can wake up tomorrow and put in a really productive day and try and keep Premax kind of on track and doing a good job. And if you think about the fundamentals of making sure that as a professional and a business person that you're doing the right things, what are they? Eat well, sleep well, get some exercise, stand out in nature, maybe get some massage. Like there's a lot of crossover between, performance as an athlete and performance as just the general human. Mm. And, I think that, like we were talking about earlier, there's so much emphasis on being so prescriptive in sport a lot of it, recovery, I think, is mental as well as physical. Mm. And, if it's music that really kind of makes you relax, or nature, or sad lamps, I think that, all those things are just worth experimenting for, not only with cycling, but for life as well.
Mm, completely, 100%. And how I like to, I think you might have been given a heads up on this, I can't remember, but I always like to summarize and kind of end podcasts with 5 tips/hacks/advice. And to give you some context on the kind of examples I've had previously, there was a cooking one, which was from a guy called Dov, who runs a wheel brand called Parkour's Wheels. And his advice was always about putting all your herbs and spices in some oil for a couple of minutes before you cook. And I do it every time. I love cooking. And my current thing is there's a guy called Ottolenghi who makes his cookbook's amazing. Basically just doing that, putting all the herbs and spices in for a couple of minutes just to release all the fragrance and the goodness out of them. Didn't think about that before. That was one of Dov's tips. Another one that I always refer to, and it really embarrasses Andy, who gave it. So Andy runs two bike brands, in fact, one called Spoon and one called Windy Miller, which are small made-to-order bikes based in the UK, custom-made carbon and steel frames. And he advised that using strawberry lube is quite good for sitting a tubeless tire on a rim. I don't know why it was strawberry lube. I have no, I don't really understand the context of why he was in that situation to try it, but apparently strawberry lube works for that. So, and then I've never tried it still, but I imagine if you've got some strawberry lube to hand, it would probably do the job. I've used fairy liquid. That works. So they've been kind of everything from that to, sort of general sort of training tips. But the reason why I asked for 5 is because I really think most people can bash out 3 quite easily. And in the 4th and 5th one are normally quite hard. And sometimes they're brilliant. Sometimes they're so shit that it's even better. So it's over to you. 5 tips.
All right. Well, I think you emailed Mia, who's in our marketing team. And I think she forwarded through the email earlier this afternoon. I read it 5 minutes before saying, all right, where's the Zoom link? And oh, holy cow, Chris wants me to give 5 life tips at the end. So I furiously scribbled down something. Yeah. And so I did have a little bit of pre-warning, but it would have been good to actually think about this for a little, because those other examples that you've suggested are so much cooler than mine. But I'll give it a go anyway. The first is never ever stop learning. So, you know, as a physiotherapist, I got to the point probably about 7 or 8 years ago. I had a specialty in knee injuries, and you know, I was regarded as I suppose I still am in some ways as having an expertise in knee injuries, and I was kind of the go-to guy. But I felt comfortable. Like when someone came into me and saw me for a knee injury, it's like, yep, I know what I'm doing. And I didn't complacent and I didn't get bored, but I was in cruise control. And I suppose because in recent years, I've flicked the switch and I'm very enthusiastic about building up Premax to make a difference for people, is that my learning experience now has just gone through the roof. You know, I'm learning about board structures and capital investment and, hiring people and motivating and diving deeper into, the skin science and all this kind of stuff. And it's completely invigorating. Like I feel like I'm back being 20 years old again and learning stuff just new. And it's refreshing. You know, I'm a guy in my middle, I'm totally in middle age. And, you know, like I've found that it's just completely refreshing. And one thing I've said to myself is I'm never going to stop. So if I ever feel like I'm comfortable again, and I think that I know it all, it's time to do something different. It's time to learn something new. So that's number one.
Great tip.
The second is your body is your temple. And I know it's a cliche. And, you know, we were talking before about how, in your younger days, you'd be happy to push yourself and punish yourself. But I also see people kind of at the other end of the spectrum. Sport and exercise is unbelievably good for you. But I suppose with the people who are listening in on this conversation, sometimes people can tip it over the other way and do a little bit too much and set up long-term kind of damage as well. And one of the comments you get back also is that maybe I wish I didn't push myself so hard when I was a bit younger. And I think that, you know, your point is like picking and choosing when you're really going to kind of have a crack at something, I think is really important, and not just going full bore all the time, because things do wear out, you know, and you see some sad tales when people kind of get into their later years that their bodies just can't do what they want to do because essentially they've done too much. So treat your body really well. And that includes kind of making sure you do an appropriate amount of training. Okay, and not underdoing it, but not overdoing it as well. So that's tip number two. Tip number three is we kind of talked about this a bit earlier as well. And I think for me, as I get older, I place more and more emphasis on it, and that is reconnecting with nature. We're so digital these days. Everything's measured, everything's tapped, everything's on the screen. And you just, whenever you kind of want an answer for anything, you go to that. Where, you know, there's actually, I don't know if you know, but there's, and I'm not part of it, by the way, but there's a cloud appreciation society on Facebook. So these guys just look at clouds, and they make a habit of just looking at clouds for an hour, and then they do take photos and put them on Facebook. But they do it. You know, and we were talking about before, whether it's just as part of a recovery, you just kind of feel and notice what's going on around you. It's like a meditative type of state. I don't do meditation, but I do, and I know exercise can be meditative at times, particularly, you know, like you just run for hours or cycle for hours. It can be awesome. But I also think it's good to slow down and really start to pay attention about what's going on in a natural world. And I think that was really highlighted to a lot of people with COVID. During COVID and the lockdowns as well, you're cooped up in apartments and you didn't have trees and birds and rivers and streams and blue skies and that type of thing. It really affected people.
Massively so.
Tip four is keep your thoracic spine flexible. So your thoracic spine is your middle back. You've got your neck, you've got your lower back, and the thoracic spine is in the middle. Everyone thinks about their neck. Everyone thinks about their back, but not everyone thinks about their middle back. And usually what happens is there's that middle part of your back can get really stiff. And then when that gets really stiff, then you start to kind of overload at the junctions, you know, the junction between your middle back and your lower back and the junction between your upper back and your neck. And that's where as physios, we see that all the time. So stretching out, you know, we spend so much time, particularly as cyclists, bent over, working, you know, on a computer, bent over, that middle back can get really tight. So doing some flexibility stretches to get better extension, so better straightening and better rotation, twisting from side to side, I think is really important as well. So stretch your middle back as well as your lower back and your neck. And then I think the last one is just when it comes to exercise, in try and involve the people around you as who you love as much as you can. And they're part of the journey and they're part of your experience. Because, you know, again, as a physio, sometimes you're almost like the bartender or the hairdresser of the athlete world, and people will tell you all their problems. And you'll kind of have people who come in who, you know, their marriage is breaking down or whatever, and you kind of drill into it a little bit, and, you know, they're training for an Ironman and they're never home. And I see that the people who do it really well, you know, they've got kids, for instance, their kids come and join them as part of training. Like, they'll ride on the bike while they go for a walk. They'll come along to the races and hold up signs for dad, you know, and they're actually there kind of cheering them on as part of the team rather than it just being a kind of like a totally selfish pursuit about how excellent you kind of can be as well. So I think, yeah, you know, like, make sure that, you know, with exercise and sport, that as much as you can, you kind of include the people. And sometimes it just might be, you know, you're telling the story about your training and that you crashed your bike, or, you know, you got swooped by a magpie or whatever it might be. I just think that, you know, it's important to kind of include them so they feel part of it. They're my five tips.
That's a great, that last one's a fantastic one. Definitely. And I think, you know, that's something that I try very consciously to do. And that's about, you know, my partner comes to a lot of the races with me. And it's about, like, she just wants to be there to support, which is fantastic. And, you know, we'll go out for a ride together, like, or day that's more of a rest day or recovery day for me, we'll go for a ride together. And same thing, it's like her brother came up here and I took him out for a ride. It was my recovery day, take him out for a ride, go for a spin, show him around the Peak District. Same thing, being in nature and being in the countryside in, you know, one of the UK's most stunning national parks, and being able to, like, you know, be at one with that and share it with friends and family. You know, family's a weird one because I have a very strange relationship with my direct family. I won't go into it, but, you know, your family is who've created you. There's a very importance to that. And they're also, your family is part of who you are fundamentally, but also your friends can become your family if, because you can choose your friends, and you tend to levitate towards people that have a similar mental attitude or outlook or sport even to yourself. So, like, being able to incorporate that into who you are is so, so important. And, like, one of my best mates, I'm very adamant, and he knows it, that I couldn't and wouldn't do ultra distance races, like 24 hour races, I should say, without him supporting. And I'm adamant of it. And the reason why is because he knows how to deal with me better than anyone else. He knows how to manage me, he knows how to talk to me, how to get me the right headspace. And, you know, he's like I always refer to him as bike dad, because he's like my on the bike dad. And so, yeah, I'm completely, they're five fantastic tips. They really, really are. I agree with every single one of them, I have to be completely honest. Yeah, you know, I think you nailed that way better than you thought you might have, to be perfectly honest with you. I thought they were good.
Oh, thanks, mate. Like I said, I scrambled them at the end, so maybe I got a little bit more warning than others, but it was a good exercise. It was a good exercise to go through, actually.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned about the magpies as well. When I rode across Australia, we got swooped, and it's scary because you don't really hear it coming. And then you just hear this, like, fluttering by your helmet, or sometimes it is literally
a crack of the beak.
Yeah. And it's just out of nowhere. And then I remember when we were doing it, we were like looking up, trying to spot them. And you couldn't really see the little buggers. You might hear them, but you couldn't really see them. They just sort of appeared. And then you hear this, whoom, and it's like, shit, get out of the way. And then just pedal as hard as you can to try and get out of sight. And we actually found, like, they didn't tend to swoop as much if we were watching them.
Yeah.
It was, but the moment you looked away, it was like full guns blazing, target time. Let's go for it.
They are brutal. They are killing machines, those birds. So yeah. And people in the UK have absolutely no idea what we're talking about, but it's just one of the pitfalls of living in Australia. Everything's trying to kill us.
And they're not, also, they're not the same. An Australian magpie is not the same sort of magpie as a British European magpie. 100%. It's like a freaking eagle, an eagle with very, very sharp claws and beaks on it. If anyone that's listening or watching or anything, I would say go onto YouTube and just search for magpie swooping. I think I'm pretty sure Shane Miller, GP Llama, has done a video about it. And it is pretty scary, but it's also hilarious at the same time when you see the videos of them. There's loads out there. Just if you go and watch that, you'll understand what's going on when we're talking about magpie swooping. Nasty little buggers.
They are.
Anyway, on that note, Randall, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. Is your God, what day are we on? Your Tuesday evening. Have a fantastic evening. Thank you for chatting shit with me for an hour and a bit. I really appreciate it. And thank you for your, you know, just general knowledge. It's really useful to have someone with your expertise and background kind of, I guess, like legitimizing a lot of this discussion about recovery and how important it is and how individual it is as well.
Yeah, no, it's been, I've really enjoyed the last 80 minutes or whatever we've been talking, Chris. You're a really interesting, inspirational guy, and it's been a pleasure. Thanks very much.
Nice one. Thank you very much. See you.